Our next case is 2022-0322, Cruina versus United Specialty Insurance Company for the appellant. Mr. Gardner, good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. Madam Chief Justice, other members of the court, Justice Dieters, it's a pleasure to argue in front of you for the first time, sir. May it please the court, counsel, my name is Richard Garner, and I represent United Specialty Insurance Company, the appellant in this case. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, Your Honor. This is a case in which the appellee Austin Cruina was injured when he was attacked by Cullen Daugherty with a knife. Both of them were residents at Brown County Care Center, what I'll call the center throughout oral argument, which was an adult group home for people with mental illness. Cruina subsequently sued both Daugherty and the center for injuries incurred in the attack. USIC, my client, insured the center, but not Daugherty, at the time of the attack under a commercial general liability policy, a CGL policy that had an assault and battery exclusion in it. The trial court correctly found that Cruina was assaulted by Daugherty and that the exclusion barred coverage. The First Appellate District wrongly reversed that decision. We're asking this court to reverse the First Appellate District and to reinstate the trial court's judgment. Now, as an alternative argument, we have also argued that if the court finds that there's coverage, that coverage is limited to $25,000 under the abuse endorsement, which is set forth in our brief at pages 5 and 6. I plan to spend my time today talking about the assault and battery exclusion unless the court has questions about the abuse endorsement. And the reason for that is that if you find for us on the assault and battery exclusion, then the abuse endorsement essentially is moot, and there's no need to get to it. Well, the facts of this case are long, but they're largely undisputed, and we lay them out in great detail for the court at pages 2 to 21. And we can go through those details and those facts as much as the court wants to, but I think the better place to start, I saw Justice Stewart already shake her head. The best place to start, I think, is with the language, which kind of picks up where we were before. And in the last case, when you were looking at statutory language, here we're going to be looking at exclusionary language. And the language of the assault and battery exclusion can be found on pages 3 to 4 of our brief. It's a full page long. Start off with it, the first paragraph. This insurance does not apply to bodily injury arising out of or resulting from any actual threatened or alleged assault or battery. And I want to pause there for a second and break that down in a couple places. First of all, the language arising out of or resulting from is very broad. It just requires a causal connection, not proximate cause. Secondly, it applies to any assault or battery. And so what we're talking about is not just an assault that might be committed by the center or its employees, but also it would include Daugherty. And so that's part of the reason why we're here. So really the question that we get to is, the first big question is, what is an assault? It's not defined in the policy, but black letter law from this court, Ohio law, says when it's not defined, then we look at the plain meaning of the word. In other words, how would an ordinary person define this word? And the plain meaning of assault is a, quote, violent physical or verbal attack, as we have set forth in the dictionary in our brief, page 27, or an attempt or threat to do so. Now, this would include civil assault, manifestly, criminal assault, and even acts that don't meet a strict legal definition that would commonly be understood as assault. And we see judges treating this identical exclusion in that way. Sixth Circuit under Kentucky law in the Coles place said you don't have to actually have an assault and battery found based upon the broad language of this exclusion. The Batters case, which was my decision, which was cited all throughout our briefing here from the Second Appellate District, talked about the plain meaning of assault as follows, at paragraph 14. The dictionaries of general usage, as opposed to a specialized reference like Black's Law Dictionary, the word assault is defined as, quote, an attack or violent onset, whether by an individual, company, or an army, end quote. To most persons other than lawyers and legal professionals, this latter definition is almost certainly the plain and ordinary meaning of the word assault. Of course, one that's even closer to home in this case, I believe, is Judge Meyer's concurrence in the lower court. At paragraph 50 of the First Appellate District's decision, she said the following, and I think it was a keen observation. From the victim Cruina's standpoint, surely he would believe he was the victim of assault, even if Daugherty was found not guilty by reason of insanity. And from a policyholder's perspective, in this case the center, surely they would believe that an attack upon a person with a knife would constitute an assault under the policy, causing it to come under the exclusion. And the record in this case is replete with such common references, plain and ordinary references. When the attack was first reported by the center, It was reported as an assault to the state of Ohio. When Jill Stoltz, the center's administrator, described the attack as an assault, she said, the reason why I did that is because that's what it was. The state of Ohio's administrative investigation described the attack as an assault. Of course, my favorite is when Corwina's own lawyers sent a notice to the center characterizing Daugherty's actions as an assault. Now, this isn't a gotcha moment for counsel where we look and we say, ha, see, I got you. You use that word. What it is a poignant example of the plain meaning of assault when people aren't busy posturing for position in a coverage case. It's just how we use the language. It's the reason why Judge Myers said what she said. It's the reason why the Second Appellate District said what they said in the Batters decision. And then finally, we need to recognize and not forget that in the lower court, the trial court expressly found that Corwina was injured by an assault in this case, even though the judge was aware of the outcome of Daugherty's criminal case, the not guilty by reason of insanity. All of these references simply recognized Daugherty's actions for what they were. They were an assault. But that's not all the exclusion says. It also talks about threatened or alleged assaults. Threatened, the plain meaning of that is to give signs or warning of or to announce as intended or possible. The parties in this case stipulated that Daugherty threatened to assault Corwina by brandishing a knife prior to actually cutting him with it. And the word alleged is very important in this exclusion. The plain meaning of alleged is asserted to be true or to exist or questionably true. This is a really important term in this exclusion, and the reason why is because assault and battery cases can be difficult to defend. Everybody on this court, either in private practice or in the court of common pleas or as a prosecutor or as a police officer, has dealt with assault and battery cases, and you know what happens. The defendant says, the wrongdoer says, that's right, I was involved in the fight, but I didn't start it. I was defending myself, or I was defending my friends, or there was an assumption of the risk, or there's something else. They were drunk. I was drunk, or there's some mental incapacity.
This go to the fact that the trial court needed to make that factual determination? Because then the appellate court concluded that based on stipulations that there was clear and convincing evidence of his mental state. Doesn't this really, whether it was an assault or not, fall squarely within the ambit of the trial court?
Yeah, it's interesting when it comes to that, right? Because in the lower case, so there's a lot to unpack there, Justice Brunner, which is why I want to start with it. In the lower court case, Daugherty was a defendant. He was sued. Ultimately, the claims against him was dismissed. In the lower court, there was never a finding by any judge that civilly Daugherty was found to be civilly incompetent or unable to commit assault or battery. And we know that the standard in Ohio and across the country, the national majority position, in fact, in the restatement of torts.
But I'm not talking about his mental intent. I'm just talking about the way the judge saw the facts of the case.
Well, perhaps, but I think sometimes that the mental illness part of this might be a red herring, because the real question is this a categorical damages exclusion that would bar coverage regardless of whether or not Mr. Daugherty was not guilty by reason of insanity, and regardless of whether or not he could commit an intentional tort, or whether or not you have to look at Mr. Daugherty's intent to determine whether or not this assault and battery exclusion is applicable. And I would submit to you that we don't even have to ever get there, because this exclusion is written so broadly, particularly with respect to alleged, that we don't even have to get to the issue of whether or not Daugherty was capable of committing an intentional tort, because the plain act itself was. Not only was it an actual assault based upon the facts and the way it was described, but it was also an alleged assault. We know that he was administratively alleged to have assaulted. We know that he was criminally indicted for felonious assault, for attempted murder, and for aggravated murder, and that that probable cause continues regardless of his not guilty by reason of insanity. We also know that he was civilly alleged to have committed assault, because when we look at the allegations in the underlying complaint in 2016 and in 2019 with the supplemental complaint, it was an allegation that he attacked Corwina with a knife, which this court said in Love versus Port Clinton will have the essential character of assault. So there's no way to get around this. And so we really have to get to the issue of, is this exclusion written broadly enough such that it would apply to Daugherty, even if we assume that he was not capable of committing assault and battery? And quite frankly, that's an issue that's open, Justice Brunner, because when we get to what happened in the lower court, there was never a finding that Mr. Daugherty was incapable of committing assault and battery in this case. There was a stipulation between Crowena and the center when they settled, but that was not of record in the 2016 case. There was no hearing by the trial court judge. There was no medical evidence or psychiatric evidence which was submitted. What we have essentially is a consent judgment entry for $1 million and then go after the insurance company.
Are you aware, counsel, of any commercial liability policies that cover the criminal acts of others?
Actually, I did not address the criminal acts, and we might have a public policy issue there, but you know, it's interesting. If you look at our brief on pages 23 to 24, and you also look at the amicus briefs of both OACTA and OII, so the Ohio Association of Civil Trial Attorneys and the Ohio Insurance Institute, both of which provided supporting amicus support for us, all of us point out that there are myriad insurance products on the market that would provide coverage for assault and battery. Not for the actual assaulter, not for the criminal that does it, but for negligent enabling of that. And so that's something that's on the market that could be purchased, that's not part of a standard CGL policy. But in this particular case, it wasn't purchased. And you know, it's not surprising to think about why it wasn't purchased. The center's a pretty small little private business. I don't know how many people they have there, but it's not many at any given time. And they're a group home that houses people with behavioral and mental problems. So you think about this as someone where maybe there would be a greater propensity, we'll say, for violence to occur there, and they get $1 million CGL policy for a flat $1,000. Now think about that. If we just have one assault and battery case where they win, they say, you know, you weren't negligent, but you spend $50,000 defending that. Think about what the difficulty it's going to be when that claim history follows them, either with respect to the insurer they have now or to another insurer, where you got to start looking at, am I going to write this policy? And so when we put on the assault and battery exclusion on a policy like this, it allows a small business like the center or like a small bar or like a school or a church to be able to afford to have that important baseline CGL coverage that's the kind of insurance coverage every business has without having to worry about what the cost would be if I have even one assault and battery there. And then if I want the assault and battery insurance, I can go and I can buy that on the market that will protect me from my negligence for allowing assault and battery to take place, but then I got to pay an extra premium for that. And it's clear that that did not take place here in this particular case. So if I go back, did I answer your question, by the way,
yes.
Justice Brunner? And Justice Brunner, did I answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
So if I go back and we were looking at the alleged part of this, and I was saying, every member of this court has said that. And so when we talk about the affirmative defenses that come up in assault and battery cases, they kind of prolong the case because we have these disputed questions of fact, correct? And so these are what we call avoidance and confession. Our confession and avoidance defenses, I'm sorry. And what they do is they say, yes, the act took place, but there's some kind of legal justification or excuse that allows me not to be liable for that act. And this is where the First Appellate District really got it wrong with the alleged part of the exclusion, because there's really three things that were fundamentally wrong about what the First Appellate District did with respect to the alleged part of the exclusion. First of all, it only limited the alleged analysis to the criminal allegations and never addressed the plain administrative or civil allegations. Number two, it sua sponte held that the allegations expired after the not guilty by reason of insanity finding. I never really understood this because Daugherty's assault was never disproven by the not guilty by reason of insanity finding. Rather, it established that the assault actually occurred, but that Daugherty wouldn't be held criminally responsible for it. And then finally, there's a presumption of probable cause due to the indictment that continues even after Daugherty, even if he was found not guilty, not because of insanity, but for some other reason. It would still be that there'd be reason to believe that this was alleged. And so we think that First Appellate District just got this wrong with respect to the alleged part of it and didn't consider this. And they did it sua sponte, so it's always dangerous for a court, I think, to go off on its own. Sometimes you have to because it's not there, but we had approached this and addressed this in pretty good detail. I've only got a minute 18 left. I think I'm just going to keep going and we'll finish up with this. The exclusion also bars any cause of action arising out of an assault or battery. And it has, then this is really important in the second paragraph on page 4, it has broad anti-concurrent causation language that bars coverage if actual or alleged injury arises out of any combination of causes or action. We think the reason why the First Appellate District ruled the way it did, because it ultimately found at paragraph 26 of its decision that it thought the exclusion would apply but for Daugherty's mental condition. It believed that Colstead required that. But the Kolstad case, different policy language, expected or intended. It also was about whether or not a not guilty by reason of insanity finding was sufficient to establish that the expected or intended injury exclusion didn't apply.
Should we overrule Kolstad, or should we just distinguish it?
I don't think it's applicable at all, Justice DeWine, so I think you can move right past Kolstad because it's not applicable under the facts for the reason why we've established on it. So I think distinguishing it is the thing to do. I think the First Appellate District was wrong to rely upon it, and they were simply confused by the holding, and I don't think it has any application to this. I see
Council,
my time.
I have a question before you sit down. What do we do with paragraph 22 of the appellate decision? It says you didn't raise this below.
That's interesting, isn't it? You know, if you look at our brief on page 35, I actually have it tabbed because this question was going to come up. I give you specific references to where we address this. And there's two things here. Let's break this down into two parts. Number one is, Justice Fisher, we deal with these issues all the time, and I can't even imagine a contract case where we're not going to talk about the plain and ordinary meaning of it. So first of all, I'm not sure you could ever waive that issue because that's black letter law in Ohio. But even if you could, we raised it in our trial brief. We raised it in our appellate brief. They are clear that we raised it in our appellate oral argument. We also raised it in our motion for reconsideration. There was no waiver here, and I can't think of any basis why anyone would say that there was a waiver here other than the fact that they didn't want to have to deal with this particular issue. Thank you very much.
Thank you. On behalf of Austin Kruina, Mr. Butler, good morning.
Madam Chief Justice, may it please the court, counsel. My name is Brian Butler, and I'm here on behalf of Austin Kruina. I would like to start with the question of waiver because Justice Fisher pointed out that that's an issue that the First District already found. And I think that USIC is trying to be very vague about what its argument was below. In its brief to the trial court and its brief to the First District, it said the exact same thing, that the assault and battery exclusion applies the plain and ordinary meanings of assault and battery, which include both civil and criminal assault and battery. It did not ask for a different meaning of the words based on what some ordinary person might think. It did not advocate for a common dictionary definition. It expressly advocated for the criminal and civil definitions that we recognize in law. Now,
Let's talk about that.
Yes.
Because I'm perplexed by this idea that because he was found not guilty by reason of insanity, that he didn't have, there was no intent, right? Because the way not guilty by reason of insanity verdict says that someone didn't understand the wrongfulness of his actions. We don't recognize in Ohio a defense of diminished capacity, which is that you couldn't form the specific intent to do the crime. So that just seems wrong as a matter, even as a matter of criminal law. What the First District did seems completely wrong.
Well, Your Honor, I would agree with you to the extent that the decision of the criminal court finding him incompetent to stand trial or not capable or not guilty by reason of insanity. But what happened in this case is that Brown County Care Center and Austin Kruina stipulated, not that he was incapable of standing trial or that he was not guilty, but stipulated that he was incapable of governing his acts by reason as a result of a mental deficiency. That stipulation.
But again, the intent in the criminal law is you have to intend to do the act. You don't, there's the idea of not being able to form the specific intent to do the act, but we don't recognize that defense. Diminished capacity is not a defense that's recognized under criminal law in Ohio. So all he had to intend was to do the actions, but it doesn't have to intend, he doesn't have to understand what he's doing, whether it's wrong or not, right? So that's first year criminal law kind of.
Correct. But the criminal finding, it was, you know, in Ohio, the statute was enacted, I believe, in 1990 that changed, took us from the common law meanings of insanity to a specific statutory language, and that's what the criminal court applied. But what this court said in Colstead was that an individual who is a result of a mental defect is incapable of governing his acts by reason cannot form the intent to commit an act for purposes of insurance coverage. And yes, the language in Colstead was slightly different.
So we should have different law for insurance coverage than for the criminal law?
That is exactly the decision that the court in Colstead was asked to conclude. Maybe, well, it was whether the
I'm not convinced that Colstead was correctly decided.
In Your Honor, that may be, but I understand your position. But the specific question the Colstead court was asked to conclude was whether, for purposes of insurance, the question of a person's mental capacity and ability to commit an intentional act is governed by the common law language, which was the mental deficiency that renders them incapable of governing their acts by reason, or the specific statutory language that Ohio enacted for purposes of the criminal defense.
Okay. Was that the same kind of factual scenario in Colstead that we have here?
It was exactly the same financial
scenario. Someone being supervised?
The individual suffered from dementia and killed another person. And there was a civil action brought against that individual's homeowner's insurance policy. And the ultimate question was whether the policy that specifically excluded acts that were intended was applicable in this case when he was unable to govern his acts by reason.
But this was about the mental status of the insured, not an agency and its negligence in keeping someone from acting that way.
I agree. Yes, that's true. But for purposes of determining construing the policy language, it does not matter if it's the insured or not. The question is whether the act was intended, or in this case, whether it was an assault or battery, which can only be an assault and battery if the perpetrator intended for the acts to occur.
But you mentioned, and in the briefs, you mentioned it repeatedly, the stipulation between Crowena and the Brown Center, right?
Yes.
That's not binding on the insurance company, is it?
Well, it is, Your Honor,
because
the trial court incorporated it into its order, finding for Crowena that the individual in this case, Mr. Doherty, was incapable of governing his acts by reason. So USIC had the opportunity to defend the case. It chose not to. So the parties stipulated to these facts. The facts became a matter of record. The court adopted those facts, making a finding, and then, so the question is, based on the facts established, based on the judgment, is USIC responsible for coverage? Again, USIC could have been involved, could have provided coverage. It didn't. The stipulation was entered. So as a matter of fact for this case, that is a fact, that Mr. Doherty was unable to govern his acts by reason. And, USIC has never raised that. It was not raised in the trial court. USIC assumed it. It was not raised at the Court of Appeals. USIC assumed that he was unable to govern his acts by reason. It merely argued it doesn't matter. This is still assault. But I think it's important to understand that, you know, this idea of a common person believing something might be an assault, I think that's an overly simplistic view of things. USIC gets into mens rea and actus reus.
Counselor, why do we have to do the criminal or civil definition of assault or battery?
Because those are the definitions that are commonly understood in the law. This court said Sutton Bank versus Progressive Polymers that a word that has acquired a technical meaning is given that technical meaning when interpreting a contract. And so USIC, when it says, don't apply the technical meaning, apply the non-technical meaning, it is contrary to this court's precedent. In it's construing a contract, the parties have to have some certainty about what these words mean. We all know what assault and battery means in the legal context. And I'm not just saying criminal or civil, but the legal context.
Do you think when this contract was created that in the meeting of the minds that took place between the insurer and the insured, that's what they were contemplating, that it had to be a criminal, every element had to be construed, or it just had involved the act of someone, what took place here, taking a knife and attacking someone?
Well, I think it has to, I think assault and battery are terms of art that specifically connote intent.
This was a group care facility where the administrators arguably knew that the folks they were going to be responsible for had to be in this special place because they a lot of times had problems with their actions. And so when they read that assault is excluded, I mean, do you really think they thought, well, only if someone had the mental capacity to actually commit a criminal assault? I mean, this was a commercial general liability policy. And your client really just assumed the position of the center when it took over the center's dispute with the insurance company.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I do believe that, you know, if we're going to speculate about what the center may or may not have done, we do have to look at what the center is. And yes, I think that the center is was in a position of understanding that most of its residents are mentally ill, and certainly can reach points, as Mr. Doherty in this case did, of having, you know, a particularly bad onset of schizophrenia, I believe it was in this case, that they do become incapable of governing their acts by reason and incapable of committing an assault. For, you know, in the one case cited in our brief, in which the court confronted an insurance policy that actually had language addressing this very matter, that the court acknowledged was directly in response to the Colstead decision, that it includes language saying that, you know, coverage is not available even if someone is incapable of governing their acts by reason. For all we know in this case, USIC presented the home with a policy with that language and negotiated it out. I mean, if we're going to speculate about what happened during the formation of this policy, we can't discount the possibility that that also occurred, that USIC did not accept a policy that expressly excluded acts committed by people who are incapable of forming intent because they're mentally ill. So, you know, that all leads really to speculation about what the intents of the parties were.
Your argument is that if they wanted it to be that specific, they should have put the language in.
Yes, Your Honor. It's very simple. I mean, the insurance company knows this is an issue. This Colstead decision is nearly 30 years old at this point. This isn't an unknown issue to arise. And
why isn't Batters persuasive for our decision?
Because Batters did not involve an individual who was mentally ill. Batters involved someone who was outside of a bar. His ex-wife was in the bar, and he was so enraged by her presence, he drove his vehicle through the front of the bar.
Right, but for purposes of insurance coverage to compensate for injuries, your focus here is on the intent of the actor.
Correct.
Did the actor possess the requisite mental capabilities of doing what he or she did to cause the injuries? But the insurance company, of course, is concerned with compensation for the injuries. So there's no question about your client's injuries, correct?
Correct.
So isn't, I guess I'm trying to wrap my head around how the injury occurred or the mental state matter, except for the fact that it matters that your client was injured. And so this is your position. I'm trying to figure out here why we need to look at the intent of the actor.
Well, I think Batters presents a good opportunity to do that. So in Batters, the individual was enraged because
right.
of his ex-wife's presence and intentionally drove his car through the front of the bar. He was arrested. He pled guilty to felonious assault. There was no question about whether it was an assault. He had pled guilty. I mean, that matter was decided. But let's say, for example, he had driven his car into the bar, and it was initially believed that he did it because his ex-wife was in there. But then it turns out after investigation, after he's arrested, after he's charged, that there was a defect with the vehicle. The accelerator was stuck. And he drove into the bar. No one would call that an assault, whether you're talking about a criminal, civil, or general understanding of the term. It's an accident. So the idea that a particular act is inherently an assault is simply wrong. It all comes back to the intent of the perpetrator.
Well, doesn't it also, Doherty's the actor, your client's the victim, but Brown Center is the insured.
Correct.
So why is there coverage?
Because Brown County Care Center was negligent in not recognizing the...
So you're arguing negligence now.
The whole case has been about negligence. The argument that USIC is advancing is that even though the case is about negligence, the claim was for negligence.
The claim was an intentional tort issue.
The claim against Brown County Center was...
No, negligence. I'm saying in the case that we're discussing right now.
Oh, in Batters?
Yeah.
Yes. But if it had turned out that the individual, for example, had a stuck accelerator or was so drunk he passed out at the wheel, those would be issues of negligence, not of intent, intentional tort. What makes it an intentional tort, what makes it an assault, is that the person formed the requisite intent to drive the vehicle through the bar. Yes, the issue here is not whether, Brown County Care Center had insurance for negligence. USIC is taking the position that it doesn't have to cover it because there was this independent act of an assault and battery. So the only question is, could that have constituted an assault and battery? The stipulated facts, completely setting aside the not guilty finding of the criminal court, the stipulated facts were that he was incapable of governing his acts by reason, which this court has already said prohibits a finding for purposes of an insurance policy that there was intent. And I would like to just take my remaining moments to make clear that USIC had a single proposition of law at advance, and it did not appeal the decision of the First District with respect to these alleged provisions, alleged abuse, alleged battery, alleged assault. It simply did not ask this court to review those findings.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll take the matter under advisement, and you'll receive a decision from the court.